Coming up on Boston Public Radio 2 days after the shootings in D.C., the question is simple. If not gun control, then what? Or do we just accept these massacres as an inevitable part of American life? Then, soon they will be 32. That's the number of Republicans on Beacon Hill. Once State Rep Dan Winslow resigns later this month, he joins us to say why he's leaving and what it says about two-party rule in Massachusetts. Then, why is it that a car described as the most innovative since the Model T can only be purchased at the Natick Mall? I've seen it there. Have you?
No.
It's in a storefront.
Then Brian McGrory, editor of the Boston Globe. Then scholar Benjamin Barber. He argues that if mayors ran the world would be in much, much better shape. And finally, food writer Corby Kummer on who's really in charge when you go out to dinner. Well, let me tell you something, diners. It's not you. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
On Monday, the day of the D.C. murders, California United States Senator Dianne Feinstein, a strong gun control advocate, by the way, said, when is enough enough? Her Senate leader, Democrat Harry Reid from Nevada, answered her question yesterday.
We're going to move this up as quickly as we can, but we've got to have the votes first. We don't have the votes. I hope to get them, but we don't have them now.
While Newtown parents probably won't take no for an answer, most agree gun control is not happening in D.C. anytime soon. So our question for you at 877-301-8970 is simple. If not gun control, then what? Or do we just accept these mass killings as a horrible but unavoidable part of American life? 877-301-8970. We can talk about mental health and whether or not laws around privacy have to be dealt with. We can talk about the NRA's solutions. But I'm serious about this. If one accepts, Marjorie, you know, everybody from John King, who we spoke with yesterday, to Harry Reid, I think any sane person realizes if the votes weren't there post-Newtown, particularly in light of the fact that it wasn't an AR-15, as we know, and it's unclear whether or not there was any kind of magazine involved, not one vote apparently has changed since the vote on the Manchin-Toomey compromise on background checks. So the likelihood is good that gun control is not in the immediate future. So you have two choices. You come up with alternative solutions to deal with hopefully preventing another Newtown or Aurora or D.C. Navy Yard, or you throw up your hands and say, let's hope these are as infrequent as possible, but there's nothing we can do.
Remember what Wayne LaPierre, who's the executive vice president of the National Rifle Association, said after Newtown, one of his oft-repeated quotes, the only good thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Remember that?
I do. You want to hear him? Here he is December 21st of last year, right after the Newtown massacre. Here he is.
I call on Congress today to act immediately to appropriate whatever is necessary to put armed police officers in every single school in this nation. And to do it now, to make sure that blanket safety is in place when our kids return to school in January.
Well, he's ridiculed. He had a solution.
Yeah, well, his big solution over and over again was that, and the lines that kept being repeated, the only good thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And what happened in D.C. on Monday?
He was a security guard
the
killed.
The good guy with the gun was right there, and it didn't do anybody any good. We got this great email this morning from Susan in Roslindale, who emailed us about 7 o'clock this morning, so mm-hmm. She was still thinking about guns from yesterday. She said, since the purpose of the Second Amendment was to have a standing militia, perhaps the militia should be reinstituted and everyone who owns an assault rifle should be put into the militia and sent to Syria. I'm willing to bet that would decrease the number of weapons. Susan from Roslindale, I like your idea very much.
877-301-8970. What is your solution? And, you know, I don't mean this facetiously. Since we know gun control is not imminent by any stretch of the imagination, maybe states are going to change law. Well, actually, some states have changed. You know what happened in Colorado last week? Two state legislators who are pro-gun control were recalled.
That's right.
So if anything, it's going in the opposite direction. If people don't have this discussion, it seems to me that you're basically saying there's nothing we can do about any of this. And, you know, let me make a naive comment. It seems to me that if the members of Congress actually cared about the safety of their constituents, they would lock themselves into Capitol Hill acknowledge that gun control is not as in the immediate cards and come up with something. Do something. Otherwise, they're making the same statement. We can't do anything about these things except celebrate the lives of the victims and excoriate the people who perpetrate these horrible killings.
Well, I have another idea. You know, I don't think that the parents in Newtown have given up, despite the fact that their lobbying did not seem to get them anywhere in terms of getting more reasonable nationwide gun control, like the background checks that you just talked about. But the shame idea, I think, you know, I always go back to the example of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. 30 years ago, people used to make jokes on Monday morning in the office. Well, I really tied one on Friday night. I was weaving all over the road coming home. Well, no one says that anymore because that is viewed as a shameful thing to do, to get behind the wheel of a car when you've had too much to drink. I think that the gun owners, all those responsible gun owners we hear and will call us today and email us today, they need to act from within. I mean, Wayne LaPierre is a nut. The new guy that they just elected. And by the way, I was looking this up this morning. Individual members of the NRA, and they are 5 million strong, so there's a lot of them, they don't get to vote on their new president. The board of directors votes. So the new guy is this Alabama lawyer. His name is Jim Porter, a total lunatic. He's called Obama a fake president. He's called Attorney General Eric Holder rabidly un-American. And he refers to the Civil War, he's from Alabama, as the war of Northern aggression against the South. In other words, you know, slavery had nothing to do with it and keeping the Union together had nothing to do with it. So it seems to me these gun owners that for whatever reasons, their own safety or their hunters or whatever they are, legitimate law-abiding gun owners, have to turn on the NRA. Because I don't think there's any – I've begun to think there's a political
– I'm going to be you.
What?
When we talk about school reform and I talk about my ideas, you say, Jim – and I'm paraphrasing you. Okay, fine. That's in 20 years when that happens, we can talk about it. For now, let's worry about this generation. We're not moving. The reality is the NRA's a million of their 5 million members is not all of a sudden going to rise up if they haven't risen up. I'd like to have the other 300 and some million Americans who have 535 representatives in Congress demand something, something. You know, let me give you an example. This whole mental health issue. I was talking to Jack Levin, who we both love, who's from Northeastern, the world's premier expert on serial and mass killings last night, about the whole issue of the mental health concerns around this Alexis guy. And we all learned yesterday that when he was in Newport, Rhode Island, called the cops to his hotel, the Marriott Residence Inn, and start talking about hearing voices in his head coming through the ceiling, whatever. Because he was never committed, and Jack said he probably should have been, but because he was never committed, then all of these things don't attach around background checks and all that sort of stuff. There are also privacy concerns. Should we be looking at the privacy issues and trying to balance? I don't know where I am on this. Trying to balance the privacy rights of individuals with the security needs of the greater population. Whatever it is unbelievable that we've put all our eggs in this gun basket. The basket isn't being carried anywhere. People have got to demand something.
On the privacy issue, you look at common sense. We all know people who have mental illness issues. Many of us know people who've been hospitalized. I don't think most of us think that you should be able to go out and get a assault weapon when you have been hospitalized
illness. Excuse me. You're continuing the same circular conversation that I don't think there should be assault weapons in the private sector either. Obviously, Congress feels differently. So are we going to continue beating the same drum forever, knowing they're not going to do anything? Or are we going to demand alternative solutions while we're waiting and growing old for greater gun control? This is not happening, Marjorie.
Have you heard of Whoopi Goldberg?
I know she is.
You know, she's a member of the NRA?
Yeah.
Well, maybe she should lead the
cause. You heard of Sue O'Connell, publisher of Bay Windows?
Member of the AR.
Fine. You're a one-trick pony, Marjorie. It ain't happening.
Listen, well, Jim, your legislative
I don't have a solution.
Hasn't gotten anywhere, has it?
I don't have a solution. All I'm saying is people have got to demand, say to their legislators, if you don't have the courage to vote for gun control, if your elected official, like from Massachusetts, is pro-gun control, but you can't convince your colleagues, do something.
The problem is everybody that talks about the Tea Party and the those little sections of America that are rabidly right-wing, in those little sections of America, the representatives of those very conservative go-gun sections are doing the will of their constituents. I mean, I think that's one of the issues. I think there has to be a sham campaign. I think we'll get there.
It doesn't apply to senators. Senators, they couldn't get 60 votes. Senators are statewide. They're not gerrymandered districts that have all people who believe the Second Amendment is absolute.
Well, it's obviously there. We know what that's about. It's about money.
877-301-8970. So if you wanted to pursue Marjorie's track, that's fine. It's not happening, released right now. But so is there a solution that you can come up with that we can convey to leaders that is something other than gun control? Before we get to you, by the way, Kathleen Alexis, who's the mother of the shooter in this case, has just issued a statement. Here she is.
His actions have had a profound and everlasting effect on the families of the victims. I don't know why he did what he did, and I'll never be able to ask him why. Aaron is now in a place where he can no longer do harm to anyone, and for that, I am glad. To the families of the victims, I am so, so very sorry that this has happened. My heart is broken.
Pretty moving.
You know something? Your heart does go out to her, because we hear this very frequently after someone who's mentally ill goes on a shooting spree. You hear of the efforts of the parents to try to get their child or their brother or their husband, whatever it was, committed, to try to get the shooter out. In the Gabby Giffords case, he was trying to get the kid, take the kid's car away from him. You know, the mother of Adam Lanza is, of course, dead. I don't know what she was doing
at his hand
in terms of efforts to keep him on the straight and narrow. But you hear this all the time, the families trying to deal. And in Massachusetts, which is pretty progressive, you hear all the time that for people that are teenagers or in their late 20s or even people that are adults, mental health services are getting shut down all the time.
Walter in Somerville, you've been patient. Oh, I'm sorry. Walter, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Walter. Hey, Walter.
So my opinion is that our politicians obviously vote against the public interest. The public majority wants gun control, wants guns off the streets. And our politicians vote against that. So I think that's a problem. It's really an industry lobbyism problem. So if you would be able to bring it back to one voter, one vote, instead of $1, one vote, then I think this issue would simply go away, because the reasonable solution to look around in other countries is simply to have less guns available, and that will reduce the occasion.
You're saying if there was, just like in Massachusetts and a couple of dozen other states that allow for voters to make and repeal laws, you're saying if there was a direct national initiative, if we all could vote on these issues, they'd pass overwhelmingly, correct?
For example, but what I want to say is like campaigns for elections, they are so much financed by the industry, and industry can pour much, much more money in than individuals, and that simply tips the interest of the industry into the foreground and quiets out the other reasonable. And here we have really a case where the majority in every poll is for gun control, and our politicians vote against that because they risk losing the financing that they get from the industry, from the lobbyists.
Yeah, you're right. And Walter, thank you for the call. A woman called yesterday and said the NRA is not about their members. They're NRA's constituency or the gun manufacturers. And by the way, there's a move. It's not getting very far right now. I guess this would be a solution, according to Walter, to repeal Citizens United, to repeal, overturn the decision that the Supreme Court made that allowed unlimited amount of money to be poured into these political campaigns. Our number is 877-301-8970.
Remember the story we talked about earlier this year? Where's the Smith & Wesson factory located?
Western Mass?
Yeah.
Number one business in the Boston Globe top 100 businesses. Yeah,
I know. You want to take away their jobs up there, Western Mass, Jim?
Well, you know what my position is on this. We'll retrain them. Dan in Worcester, you're next on Boston Public Radio, Jim and Marjorie. What are your suggestions, Dan?
Hello, Marjorie and Jim.
Hey there.
Hi.
A lot of things going on in this conversation, but here in Massachusetts, Margie, this, you know, progressive Massachusetts, there are a lot of gun owners here in Massachusetts, so it's not just in the backwater country, states and whatnot, hillbillies and all that sort of stuff. Guns are all over the place.
Well, by the way, Dan, let me just interrupt you and not speak for him. A guy who's about to join us in 10 minutes, Dan Winslow, a pretty progressive guy in a lot of things, who's retiring from the legislature, is a big Second Amendment advocate, and most people I know are not calling him anything close to right-wing or nutty. But go ahead, Dan.
No, that's exactly right, Jim. A lot of sensible people who own guns, myself being one of them. However, the problem I've been railing against all these years, for years and years, is crime. You know, Newtown, the Fort Hood, this recent thing at the Navy base in Washington. crimes were perpetrated at these places. Criminals were either dispatched by the police, or they dispatched themselves, or they were captured. Either way, we've got to get tough on crime in this country and mental illness. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people who have mental illnesses, and we're really giving a pass to the mental health industry, I should call it. You know, you remember the college days, everybody went to school and got some sort of a degree in mental health, but didn't have anything else that they wanted to do. Now you got tons of people dealing with this particular
You don't, because as you know from your own life, Dan, you know, if you get some dread disease, a physical disease, you're going to get covered for massive tens of thousands of dollars, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars of expensive treatment. If you have a mental illness, you're not going to get that kind of money from your insurance company. And by the way, Dan, do you belong to the NRA?
No, I don't. I have a permit to carry, but I haven't carried a gun or hunted in years.
Yeah.
But I'm a believer in the process. And Margie, you know, I agree with you. It's terrible that mental illness is not covered by insurance or at minimum.
Well, it's covered, but in a limited fashion, yeah.
Exactly. And therein lies a huge problem. It's just one of the problems. It's not the gun. It's not the majority of people who have guns are responsible with them. And
Dan, excuse me. To me, it is partly the gun, because I don't think anybody should have one of these 30, these high-capacity magazines that allow you to kill 20 people in a minute. I don't think anybody should have those.
Dan,
I agree with you, Margie.
Well, since you agree with Marjorie, which is a rare moment, Dan, we know that, we're going to let you go. Thank you.
I'm glad Dan does not belong to the NRA.
Well, I thought you wanted him to belong to the NRA so he could lobby his leaders. Isn't that your whole
plan here? No, I think you need someone. You need someone that – I think it needs to come from – coming from Massachusetts, where everybody expects this, or coming from a liberal Democrat where everybody expects this, there has to be somebody kind of from the belly of the beast that gets up and says, you know, I've got 12 guns and I've got 17 pistols and I've got this and I've got that, but we have to start being reasonable. We're law-abiding gun owners. We want there to be back. The gun owners have to, there has to be a charismatic leader from there, if you ask me.
Well, you know, Dan
because
just mentioned
your charismatic politicians aren't really getting anything done.
Dan just mentioned the mental health issue. Jack Levin, who we both have great respect for, we mentioned a minute ago, he's been saying for years that's where the crux of the issue. But you know what that means? It means more money. It means government has to invest more in comprehensive mental health services for people.
I'm not making a joke here, but if you think that your microwave oven is talking to you and trying to infiltrate your body and you have to go to three different hotels because the floors are sending you messages, I mean, this is not just, you know, you get a little anxiety and depression. This is in a whole other area. I mean, that's really?
Well, you know what? Again, Jack Levin, I'm sorry to quote him 42 times when he's not here. When he's with me last night, he said, based on what I know, the guy should have been committed. And why? I don't know this, but why do you assume he's not committed? How many beds are there? I mean, the reality is the system, the mental health system. And by the way, it's one of the few areas where I think right and left on this gun issue tend to agree that mental health is at the core of the problem. It's the reality is there's no appetite for spending more money on almost anything these days.
Mike from Haverhill, what do you think, Mike?
Well, I think many of these shooters are not mentally ill as well. Hearing voices, a lot of people hear voices.
They do?
I would suggest most people who hear voices are probably mentally ill, Mike. And I'm not a shrink, but I think that's I feel comfortable making that comment, but go ahead.
But many shooters are not mentally ill, and hearing voices does not make one dangerous. However, I called in for a different reason.
Sure.
A different solution, a non-governmental part of the solution. Stop reporting these shootings. We stop reporting suicides by teenagers because of copycat teenagers killing themselves. There was a wrap up on these shootings. The more we report them, the more people copy the behavior.
Mike, let me interrupt you to say you don't mean no reporting. You mean just limit it dramatically, I assume, right?
I don't know. Just as I don't know, I admit, I don't know what the answer is. I'm in favor of gun control. However, I recognize there are 300 million guns out there in America.
You know, Mike, let me just say, you're not alone on this media thing. James Fox, who writes a blog for Boston.com and is a colleague and close ally of Jack Levin's, who we've been talking about, has written blogs after recent shootings saying there is too much media coverage. One, we shouldn't use the name of the shooter nearly as much as we do. And I'll tell you one place that's been, and Mike, thanks for the call, been very careful about this, even though I'm not sure if it's a cover or not, is CNN goes out of its way to endlessly talk about the lives of the people who are lost. But then they obviously proceed, as you know, to talk about Aaron Alexis too. But there are a lot of experts in the field. I'm not amongst them, who believe that less coverage is better for society.
But again, you look when you find out the background of these people that do these mass shootings, many times they're severely disturbed.
I agree. Tim, you're in West Newbury. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Tim.
Good afternoon, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for making it.
I'm afraid we're going to have to resign ourselves to the current situation as far as gun control is concerned until we fix our system of government. Our system of government is severely broken. I'm 61 years old, so I can say, looking back, I've been paying attention to politicians for 40 years, and I've never seen this system so dysfunctional. There are no charismatic leaders, like Marjorie mentioned, to pull us out of this situation. We've gone too far. Basically, we don't have a representative democracy or a democracy that represents the vast majority of people. We have an oligarchy.
So what do we do? I mean, most people agree with you if who've been watching it for decades.
You're saying
it's
we have
the
to
worst
resign
it's
ourselves.
Been. No, but you're saying we got to change the way our the structure of what change could we make
Get
that would make it more responsive?
It.
Well, is that what it is, Tim?
We have to take the money out of politics. Yeah. We have to. When we had this guy Barack Obama that was elected twice, and yes, he got millions of dollars from corporate interests and the oligarchical interests, but he got a lot of money from individuals.
He did.
And he can just reform the system and put it back in the hands of the individuals. I mean, if there's 200 million middle-class people and they all chip in $10, we can beat the 2 million or 200,000 millionaires that are chipping in more money. I mean, we talk about the 99% and the 1%. Gee whiz, 99% ought to be able to overcome 1%.
Yeah, but Tim, what you're suggesting is almost a money war, and I thought you were going where, and thanks for the call, where Marjorie was going, which is public financing, taking money out of politics so it's not a race to the bottom, for lack of a better expression, on money. Can we raise and spend more money than the other guys?
Term limits. But you don't agree with that?
No, I don't.
Well,
I feel so
passionately about term limits is because people, at least in their last term, would vote their conscience instead of voting what would get them reelected. And I think that when you have career politicians that all they care about is getting reelected, then they're too afraid to vote their conscience.
So
anymore.
Should they all be one-termers?
No.
Then they'd be voting their conscience the whole time. They never run for re-election.
I think the argument that you make that people have to kind of know the ropes a little bit is fine. But I don't think, especially now that I'm reading this Town book by Mark Leibovich, I'm just so appalled by how corrupt it is and how it's all about money. I just think it's hopeless.
Well, we're going to now talk to a guy who's term limited himself, Marjorie.
That's right. We are going to be joined in just a couple of seconds by State Representative Dan Winslow. In 11 days, he's going to be leaving Bay State politics to become an executive in a software company. We're not sure. We think there might be how many Republicans left up at the State House, Jim?
32 after
32.
Him.
Pretty depressing. He's going to join us in Studio 3 to go over his big change, Representative Winslow, when we come back.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And as we speak, I've done the math. There are a total of 33 Republicans on Beacon Hill. There are 200 reps, by the way, and senators, if you're doing the math. Three in the Senate, 30 in the House, none in statewide office. When Dan Winslow announced the press conference earlier this week, most of us assumed it was to say he was seeking to change that. Running for Attorney General, the office of Martha Coakley, would be vacating. Most of us, including me, were wrong. Come September 29th, there'll be one less Republican on Beacon Hill. Innovative, creative-thinking Dan Winslow, he's a representative from Norfolk, has submitted his resignation. The former judge, counsel to Governor Mitt Romney, counsel to the Scott Brown for Senate campaign, joins us to tell us why and what it means for the future of two-party government in Massachusetts. Dan Winslow, nice to see you.
Well, thanks for having me on.
So, Dan Winslow, you have claimed that this is about not being able to pay the bills. You got two kids, college kids, one kid in private school. It's a lot. We all can relate to your pain there. Is that really why you're leaving? It's all about being able to make a living and pay the bills?
Well, it's that, and then juxtaposed with the fact that politics at a statewide level has become in Massachusetts a rich man's game. And I've got to go back into the private sector to earn some dollars. I'm always nervous, by the way, about people that get wealthy in the public sector. So I'm going to go back to the private sector and try to earn some dollars. This company that I'll be joining is really at the cutting edge of software innovation, and I'm excited to be part of that, as sad as I am to leave Massachusetts. My hope is, Marjorie, that the future will allow me to come back.
How much money are you making in the new job?
Not nearly enough.
Okay. You know, Dan,
You're going to get to go? You're going to get to go to India and Saudi Arabia and Germany and Canada and Japan and China and Australia. That sounds like fun.
It's going to be a lot of work. What's interesting is, and not to bore you, but companies have technology budgets, and CIOs, the chief information officers, have what they call the 80-20 rule. 80% of our technology budgets in America are spent on maintenance of existing software. Only 20% is spent on innovation.
Wow.
And this company is trying to move that 80 to 40, so we spend 60% on innovation. And it's exciting.
Okay, if we ever allow you back in the studio, we can talk about that. But I'm not buying it, with all due respect. Your reasoning, let me tell you why. First of all, I was amongst the school of people who said Dan Winslow is running for the United States Senate. He may win the primary. You didn't. He probably will lose the final. And then a la Joe Malone against Ted Kennedy a couple of decades ago, his profile will be really high to run for statewide office. When you ran for the United States Senate, you still had the same family. You still knew that politics was a rich man's game. You obviously decided you could live on that salary, which is not that much more than being attorney general or governor. So what epiphany did you have since that? I'm serious. I don't mean this critically. Yeah. What epiphany did you have, Dan, that caused you to say all of a sudden I can't afford to do this?
Yeah, I actually helped negotiate the book deal for Scott Brown when he became the U.S. senator. I was his lawyer, and so.
Are you really? You did help negotiate?
I sure did, okay. And so I know that there's a market for books by U.S. senators. There ain't no market for books by attorney generals, and so that would have been it. And so with three tuitions, and I think the salary's around 160, and mortgages. And hey, listen, my start in life was in a trailer in a pasture in Amherst, Massachusetts. I'm really proud of the fact that I've come up. I've done well, I think, in the practice of law. The law's been very good to me. But my life is as a citizen public servant. I have never intended to be full-time and forever in public life. I've always gone back and forth, and when the fiscal needs of the Winslow family require it, I've gone to the private sector and have been able to do that.
You know, when Charlie Baker was a regular Tuesday open mic guest of ours prior to becoming the Republican – well, he's probably going to be the Republican candidate. He's at least a Republican candidate for governor. He would say to us pretty regularly, and correct me if I'm mischaracterizing it, Marjorie, one of the things I have to decide before I decide if I'm going to run is whether a Republican can win statewide in Massachusetts. My take is this, and again, not challenging your thinking – there are three senators out of 40 in the state Senate who are Republicans. And Bob Hedlund, 2 days ago, basically told us he's quitting. He said it's going to be sooner rather than later. So they're going to be two unless he's replaced by a Republican. You bring it down to 29, even though there was a doubling to 30 in the last election. There are a scad of Democratic candidates for statewide office. Virtually no Republicans have announced. Can't you make the case that, at least in the back of your head, it was, is there a place for a Republican in Massachusetts? That had to be part of your thinking.
Well,
and even if it wasn't part of your thinking, answer the question. Is there a place?
Yeah, there is.
What's the evidence of that?
The I think that people, the voters, are coming to the realization that monopoly is bad. We've got a monopoly government, and it's just bad.
What's the evidence that they've come to that conclusion?
Well, perhaps aspirational thinking on my part, but it's not so much that the voters of Massachusetts have left the Republican Party. I think that the Republican Party nationally has left the voters of Massachusetts. And I've always
and you've suffered the fallout. You mean
well,
in state?
I've described our state and our Commonwealth really represents a different kind of Republican cat, as far as I'm concerned. And I think we necessarily have to be big tent Republicans on social issues, but our strength has been and will continue to be fiscal and jobs and good government and ethics because we are not beholden to the public sector to be able to pay our bills. And that's exactly why I'm going to step away from public life for the time being and to try to, get some bucks in. And, if I can come back into public life, I will be beholden to no one but the voters who sent me there.
But that is obviously a big deal if you're running for Congress, a Republican running for Congress. Or Republican running for United States Senate, less of a big deal, clearly, in Massachusetts if you're running for governor or attorney general, because that's you're not influenced necessarily by the national party and these Fruit Loop types out in other far-flung areas of the country when you're governor here.
Listen, I think Congress on both sides of the aisle is a catastrophe for America right now. And I would hope that voters in Massachusetts would send a Massachusetts brand Republican down. We don't need another voice in the Democratic caucus to change things. We need a voice in the Republican caucus, I think, to move the country in the right direction. And my hope is that we'll get some good candidates in 2014 and 2016.
So you're leaving before your term is done. You're leaving September 29th?
I am.
Now, Jim Brady, when Timothy Murray, the former lieutenant governor of the Commonwealth, left early to take a job as running the Chamber of Commerce up in Worcester, trashed Timothy Murray for days. Why don't you go ahead and trash Dan Winslow here?
He's I trashed his leaving in the middle of his term.
You trashed him.
I can make a commitment. I hadn't thought about that, actually, until you brought it up. I'm actually not going to trash Dan, even though I like people to honor their commitment. And it's a good question about whether or not you thought about that. We'll get to that in a second. You did make a commitment to serve. I mean, the honest difference is Tim Murray is one of one, meaning he can't be replaced. Dan Winslow, wait a second, is one of two, one of 160, and there'll be a replacement for him in 3 or 4 months.
Excuse me.
Constitutionally, you can't replace lieutenant governor.
Yeah, he's one of a much smaller number of Republicans, Jim.
Well, no, he's not. He's one of 30, and Murray was one of one lieutenant
governor. Yeah, okay.
Here's a good question, Margie. But how about that? Did
Many
you think about
don't...
that at all?
Yeah, I did.
Honorable character.
Yeah, absolutely. Didn't want to leave. Would like not to have left. That was absolutely a factor. I actually thought about, because I have to do what I have to do to get the family's finances in order, but I actually thought about holding on. But at that point, it would have been about me. It would have been about me holding on to the office and not doing 100%. And I'm reasonably confident that it's going to be a Republican successor. It's the most Republican district in Massachusetts. But I believe that the people that think they're so darn important in public life that they can't be replaced are they exactly the folks we need to have be replaced, and it's good to have turnover.
Despite your aspirational thinking, to use your word a couple of minutes ago, and I've said this the last couple of days, I think I said it to Hedlund, Senator Hedlund, I'm not sure. I know a lot of Democrats who are not like fire breathers who think it is a problem that we're nowhere close to two-party government in Massachusetts. It would actually be good for Democrats to fear for their jobs. It seems to me that if Charlie Baker does not win this race, which is not that – well, it's a year plus. If Charlie Baker doesn't win this race and we go into the race with potentially two Republicans in the Senate, 29 Republicans in the House, maybe you pick up a few, maybe you're not, you can't say anymore. You can't say the morning after the election, all we have to do is regroup and rethink. There's nothing left in the party. Is that – you'd agree with that. If that's a – come the morning after next November, if Charlie Baker is not the governor, the Republican Party should basically shut the doors. Should they not?
Lays the groundwork for my triumphant return to Massachusetts.
You agree with me, though, don't you? I mean, really.
I think that, I support Charlie Baker.
No, that's not my question.
I hope he wins.
And if he doesn't?
My hope is that he is. My expectation is he's going to win.
But if he doesn't turn off the lights, that is, you feel the same way I do, don't you?
Let's talk then. The phone rings both ways.
He feels the same way.
Tell
I
people why it's such a big deal to have just one party running the entire state? Why it is a problem for the voters and the cities and towns?
Sure, competition is good. Yeah. Competition is good, whether it's in business or in government. You know, when you've got somebody who's willing to take your seat, who's willing to work against you, it makes you work that much harder, that much smarter. And now in Massachusetts, so much power has been concentrated. I call it the oligarchy, and I've teased them on Twitter and comparing them to the, you know, North Korean dictators. But the fact is, and they're nice
Bob
people.
Bob Patrick actually praised you yesterday. I hope you're going to be nice, by the way.
I noted the governor's – he ruined me, by the way, for the Republican primary forever. but the fact is that competition is good, and we've got so much concentration of power at the higher reaches of the legislature. It's not healthy. And I think that democracy is supposed to be noisy. Democracy is supposed to be contentious in a civil way, and that the exchange of ideas is good for democracy, and we just don't have enough of it in Massachusetts.
How old were you when you were appointed judge? Like 11? How old were you when you were – I'm serious.
36.
36. Last question, which is the toughest one for me to ask because it's of great concern to Marjorie. If you're leaving by September 29th, does that mean the speed limit will never be raised to 70 miles an hour? Which is – it does, doesn't
thankfully,
it?
Thankfully, that bill is actually co-sponsored in a bipartisan way by other very able representatives. I did learn, by the way, and you can check this on Wikipedia, there's something called the Solomon's Curve.
Yeah.
And it stands for the proposition that the less disparity between speeds, the safer a highway becomes. So if you raise the speed limit to 70, we will actually decrease motor vehicle accidents
there
in Massachusetts highways.
You go.
Hey,
Dan Winslow,
lots
that
of
was
luck.
Brilliant.
Stay in touch
Thanks
with
so
us.
Much.
We wish you a lot of luck.
Dan Winslow, thank you very much for being here. For 11 more days, he's going to be here in Massachusetts as a Republican state senator based in Norfolk.
State rep, too.
The state rep, excuse me. Thank you very much, Jim. And we're going to talk about something else totally different. It has to do with cars, Dan Winslow, about electric cars. When it comes to cars, there's something Massachusetts isn't keen on doing, and that is why the Massachusetts state auto dealers are taking on the Tesla. We're going to discuss that little tiff between the dealers and the Tesla up next on 89.7 WGBH.
Mayor Menino's had a great 20-year run.
WGBH News political contributor Peter Katsas.
Partly out of respect, partly out of fear, the candidates are really reluctant to go out on the ledge. WGBH News will be part of the process of pushing them to get more specific, to tell us their visions of what this city will be.
Get to know all the Boston mayoral candidates online at WGBHnews.org.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Skinner, presenting American and European works of art at auction, Friday, September 20th, featuring paintings, prints, and photography. The auction includes original works by Fitzhenry Lane, Alexander Calder, and others. SkinnerInc.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie again. How is it that in Massachusetts, the only place where you can buy what is being described as the most innovative car since the Model T is the Natick Mall? Here with us to explain why the Massachusetts auto dealers are taking on the Tesla, which, by the way, is supposedly the ultimate all-electric car, is Edgar B. Herrick III. He is obviously the man behind the Curiosity Desk. Hello there, Edgar.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Marjorie.
Okay, before we get into this controversy, please tell people, because I knew nothing about this Tesla. Fill us in on what the Tesla is.
So the Tesla, this is one of the many companies of Elon Musk. He's the guy behind SpaceX, and he does this Tesla. He does a lot of TED Talks. You know, he's one of these big thinkers. Types. And basically, it's an all-electric car, but the idea here is that it is a luxury, high-end all-electric car. So first of all, right out of the gate, it's really expensive. The first Tesla that they produced a few years ago cost over $100,000. This newest one is called the Model S. This is their second crack at it. And this one is down to about $65,000.
And how is it that, you know, Dan Winslow, as he left, mentioned to us, you should have asked me about the electric. I forgot when he's running for Senate. He told me he owns a Volt. And actually, the Volt is in the parking lot. We've all heard about so many disappointments in terms of price,
that's right,
performance.
That's right.
Why is this one? And I, by the way, I saw one in Montreal a few weeks ago. I went to the Natick Mall, not to see it, but I happened to see it in the storefront. It is unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean,
why is this one different from all which came before?
It's two things. It's performance, and by performance, I mean speed, right? Like one of the downsides here of all the electric cars is they're worried about power. This thing is really powerful. It's really fast right off the line, right? And the other thing is the distance that it's able to travel per charge.
What distance
is it? So it's 200 plus miles on every charge.
Wow.
And then on top of this, Elon Musk, and he just talked about, I think maybe last week or 2 weeks ago, he said he's going to get in a Model S, he's going to drive across the country. What Tesla's doing now is they're building charging stations
over
the country. So the idea is you can swap the battery out, or you go to these charging stations, you get a little bit of a boom, and then you're gone 200 more miles plus. So, you know, he's kind of betting that, you know, between performance and availability of charges, this is going
to
work.
Before we get to the controversy, and we're close to it. And by the way, if you've driven a Tesla, if you've seen it at the Natick Mall, if you have a friend who owns one, actually one of Chet Curtis's very close friends just bought one. He was talking to us at the Broadcasters Hall of Fame lunch the other day when Chet was inducted. You know what he said to me? It was great. I said, how much did it cost? I didn't know if I should say it. And he said, ask him. And he said, $103,000. He says, but let me tell you, I'm saving so much on gas. In any case, but if you fall into that category, you've seen it, you've driven it, you want to drive it, give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. How many have been sold in Massachusetts?
Between 300 and 400
have been
sold here in Massachusetts. Well, that's just the Model S.
I do want to ask you, though, okay, you do save obviously on gas, but how much does it cost you electricity-wise?
The charging stations are theoretically supposed to be free. I mean, that's kind of the idea behind these charging stations. You know, Tesla's – this is part of Tesla's business model, right? They're not making money on these cars yet, but they're thinking if they can be the people who own the infrastructure, own the technology, own the battery technology. They work with other companies like BMW and stuff like that to help them with some of their part electric stuff. So Tesla's kind of betting that the idea is if you pay for the car, you know, the electricity is going to cost you, but not nearly as much as the
gas.
Even
if you're charging it in your own garage.
The other thing that should be said is for those of you, and that's most of us, I think, who are like $65,000 car, that's never going to happen for me. I'm never going to drive it. Forget it. Two things about that. One, Tesla's trying to half the price again for their next one. So within 3 years, they're hoping to have a car around $35,000, and that would be a game changer. And this week, GM said they want to get into it with Tesla as well, and they're going after them. And within 3 years, they want an all-electric car, say they will have an all-electric car that'll be somewhere around $35,000 that'll go 200 plus miles per charge. So we're talking about this coming down the pike for regular people pretty soon.
You know, Edgar, I have to say, thank God you exist. And there's I'm sure your family feels that way.
Mom would agree with you.
No, but there's a reason for this. I happen to be at the Natick Mall for totally unrelated, I mean, shopping reasons. I leave the food court, which is where I spend most of my time there. It's rather expansive. And all of a sudden, I see this car in the window. And then I walk in and I check it. It's gorgeous. It is totally gorgeous.
What does it look like?
The one I saw is black
and it's sleek,
is gorgeous.
Little?
No, it's like a regular sedan kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a sedan.
It is.
But here's – literally, honest to God, I was curious. That's the segue.
Perfect.
I'm saying, what is this doing being sold in a mall? I've never seen a dealership.
I know.
And that's the controversy. What is the controversy?
Well, the big thing is that Tesla is trying to do something – and this is funny because there's all these innovations, right? It's won the 2013 Motor Trend Car of the Year. Consumer Reports gave it its highest rating ever in the history of giving ratings for cars.
Is that so?
Yeah. Can you believe that? And all of it's pointing to, you know, it's super safe. It's really fast. It's all electric. But their real innovation here is their sales model. I mean, which is to sell directly to consumers.
Manufacturer to consumer through things like the Natick Mall
through their
storefront.
Stores. So basically they're taking a cue from somebody like Apple.
Apple, sure.
And it's exactly like that. You go into a mall, like you go into the Cambridge Side Galleria. There's an Apple store there. It's a sleek looking store. You walk in, you can buy an Apple computer or get your Apple computer serviced there. And it's made by Apple and it's sold to you by Apple in a mall. So the problem is that there is all kinds of law around this particular industry in this state, and it's not just Massachusetts, in all of these other states, in like 48 out of 50 states, there's all kinds of laws that basically protect the industry as it is, which says to varying degrees that you cannot, if you are a car manufacturer, sell a car directly to a consumer, that you have to go through an intermediary, that you have to sell your car to an auto dealer who is independent
of the manufacturer.
They're not a manufacturer owned. They're independently owned. And then there's all kinds of stuff. It's what they call a sales and service agreement. There's all this stuff that gets that has to comply with the law in an agreement between the dealer and the manufacturer, in theory to protect both the dealer and the consumer, and then that dealer is allowed to sell to consumers, but you can't sell direct.
So what is the rationale for treating the auto sales industry different from virtually anything else? The safety? Is that what they say? Is it a safety concern, protection of the consumer? What's the argument?
There are all kinds of arguments. There are all kinds of arguments. One, which is, you know, safety and consumer, but, you know, Tesla, and I think Tesla has a pretty good argument against that. They say, well, look, we're the manufacturer. Why wouldn't we want to service our, you know, person just as well as they would? You know, there's a few of them. This law grew up over time, and like what happened was early on when, you know, cars first started happening, there were like hundreds of people manufacturing cars, and these companies would go belly up left and right. So both the consumer needed protection in case some car company made a car with proprietary like technology, and then they went belly up, and you had bought one, and you were, you know, kind of left out there in the dark.
You know,
you don't need it now.
There are two questions that I hadn't thought about until you were speaking. I left this storefront in Natick Mall saying, what a beautiful thing. I didn't know what the price was then. I only learned it at this lunch a couple of weeks ago. Number one, how do you test drive at Tesla? And number two, where do you service a Tesla? What do you do with either of those things?
Okay, first of all, they have a service center in Watertown.
Oh, they do. Okay.
And when I talked with the people at Tesla, they said that before they open more stores, there's only one store in Massachusetts,
Natick
the one
Mall.
At the Natick Mall. Before they open more stores, they'll plan to open more service centers. That's kind of their idea. You test drive it. You go to the mall and you test drive it. You can now test drive. You couldn't at first because the Mass Auto Dealers Association has been taking suits against Tesla from the beginning. They tried to stop them from opening the store in the first place.
Could they prevail? I mean, is there litigation?
There is litigation.
The direct sale by the manufacturer could be shut down.
It could be
As we're having this conversation.
God, I hope it's not. You know why?
Why?
Because as everyone knows who's bought a car at a dealership, and I've almost never done it because it's such a horrific experience, you know, that song and dance you have to go through, the salesman tells you, oh, well, I'll go into the manager and see if you can knock off a few grand here, or maybe I'll throw in something for free. You have to go, like, take a test course in how to buy a car from a dealership. They treat you in this just such a slippery way at most of these dealerships.
There's no negotiation at this deal, right?
Yeah,
the price is the price.
But you know what?
I love that.
Marjorie,
the price is the price.
What's interesting is I find that one of the most compelling arguments that the Mass Auto Dealers Association has actually has to do with that haggling. They make the point, and it's a decent one. They say, all right, let's imagine that we let Tesla – we change the law, or we sort of let this go and we let Tesla sell direct. Their argument is – that every company is going to want to sell direct. All right, so Ford's going to want to sell direct. Chevy's going to want to sell direct, et cetera. They say that right now there's somewhere between 400 and 500 dealerships in the state of Massachusetts. All right, so they say let's imagine right now those 400 or 500 dealerships are owned and operated by 400 or 500 different independent people who, by the way, are Massachusetts residents. Mm. They're, you know, putting jobs here in Massachusetts.
That's
they're paying
right.
tax here in
yep.
Massachusetts. Now let's imagine that instead of that, some say the disaster scenario is a bunch of auto dealers are going to start closed. I say imagine that doesn't happen. Then what will happen is instead of 400-plus dealerships owned by 400-plus different people, you have 400-plus dealerships owned by 20 different companies. All right, and the prices are going to be the same at all of those dealerships because a Ford is going to sell its Ford price the same at all of its Ford locations. They argue that right now, in addition to the fact that there's a bunch of a Ford dealer who's kind of competing with a Chevy dealer, since they're independently owned, the two Ford guys are also trying to beat each other's price. So that they argue that if you're a savvy consumer, that can drive the price down for you. You argue that it's a total pain in the butt to have to haggle.
And
this is where I'd love to hear what people think about that.
There was a place about 15 years ago, I bought a used minivan at a used car dealership where the price was on the windshield. That was it. Take it or leave it.
You like that?
I loved it.
All you have to do is printout from a place like Consumer Reports. You go in, you hand it to the guy, and the guy gives it to you for within $50 of the price.
You're a man.
I am a man, at least.
I think it's different
many
for women
think
in
that
these
to
dealerships.
Be the case. 877-301-8970. So there are two questions on the table. One, do you have any experience with a Tesla? Edgar will be here to answer your questions or respond to them. And two, what do you think about this back and forth? Do you want manufacturers to be able to sell their cars directly to the people like Tesla wants to do? Or do you find the arguments that are being conveyed by Edgar on behalf of the dealers, he's not advocating either side, do you find them compelling? Where do you fall on this issue? Let's start in Cambridge, hometown of one of my favorite people. That'd be me, Marjorie, in case you were – and I want to make sure you're paying attention. You are first or next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Josh.
Hey, how are you?
Excellent. Thank you for the call.
Excellent. Three quick points, maybe four. One is looking at the Tesla online, and where you can configure it. The price, once you put tires and things on it, seems to be closer to $80,000 or $90,000.
Yeah, fair.
Once you put tires on it.
Yeah.
Okay. The second point is the charging stations and the range. So over 200 miles on the rapid charge or the full 7-hour charge. So for most of us who might have to go, let's say from Cambridge to Maine and back in a day, that's not really going to work unless I can find a rapid charge station near where I'm going.
Mm-hmm.
So it just makes it difficult and more of a strategic situation for me to drive anyplace. Third point is that Jim and Marjorie, I think that you guys are the best thing to happen to Boston Public Radio for their daytime programming. Instead of whatever it was before.
The surprise.
That's almost
third
as good
there.
As your point the that the car should have tires on it, by the way. What's your fourth point? Thank you, Josh. Oh, that was it? Josh. Thanks.
Fourth point would be if we allow the manufacturers to actually sell directly to the public, I'm concerned that would take money out of the state from the folks I would consider to be entrepreneurs as traditional and as ingrained in the car industry as they may be.
Josh, we got it.
You're just going to end up. Yep.
Thank you for the call. By the way, and for those who are responding to either that point, the final point, or what Edgar said about it, a similar sort of thing, most of these dealers are not Ernie Buck and Herb Chambers.
That's
I'm
right.
going to criticize either
Some
Ernie or Herb
Chambers.
Some
of them are very big, but a lot most of them are lot, one guy and his family owns one dealership.
Yeah.
And it's a good point. It's a very good point.
Every time
they employ,
you step in the door, it costs you $300.
Yeah, but the dealers employ thousands of people in the state. And by one of the lawmakers that I spoke with, Senator Mark Pacheco, he puts it at somewhere around 20% of all retail sales in this state are car sales.
Car sales?
You know,
and he obviously is, I assume, because doesn't he have the auto mile or whatever in his district?
He does. He has the auto mile in his district. I mean, that's the interesting thing. Not only are these guys battling this out in the courts, but they're also battling it out in the state house right now. So you have Representative Linsky, who's kind of, for lack of a better way of saying it, he's on the side of Tesla. He's
he
the
represents
guy.
Natick,
he represents Natick, right?
Say.
Okay. So
I lost
and then
my
Senator
rear
Pacheco.
Windshield wiper. I had to get a new reel because
yes.
I wouldn't pass to get my inspection sticker. I go to the dealership.
Shocking.
It'll remain unnamed. $350. I go across the street to the mobile station. Yeah. Guess how much my new windshield wiper cost? $70.
Yeah, but that's independent of this discussion. Whether it was manufactured directly or not, you can still buy
dealers. It's the hostility.
But what's
dealers.
Interesting to me is this is kind of a very tangible microcosm of the more theoretical argument about free market versus government getting in there. And I think for anybody who kind of has that argument in their head or with people, this is a good one to look into and say, how should we actually
work this
out? Hey, Edgar,
one last thing before we go back to the calls. Wake of that first call, I think it was Josh, or my apologies, whatever his name was, the $35,000 model that apparently is a year away.
Yeah,
well, that actually will that actually come with tires, or do you have to
with tires? It'll be somewhere around $104,000. The tires on the $35,000 model are actually more expensive.
Don't forget the brakes. We need the brakes.
Let's go to Framingham, where Rick is on the phone. Hey, Rick.
Yeah, hi, Jim and Marjorie. This is Rick Holmes with Metro West.
Oh,
News.
From the Metro West. A fabulous paper and a great writer. Hey, Rick, how are you? What's going on?
Well, I wanted to talk to you because I wrote a piece about the Tesla a couple of weeks ago.
What'd you say?
I went down to the Natick Mall and I took a test drive and, I wanted to write all the stuff that you're talking about the anti-competitive practices and the fight with the dealers and the public policy issues that are implied in this business. And then I took a test drive, and all I wanted to do was tell all my friends about how much fun it was.
Yeah. Why was this so much fun? How great was it, Rick?
You don't realize, all of us who've been driving, obviously, internal combustion engine cars for all our lives, don't realize that there is you get used to the lag between hitting the accelerator and actually accelerating. It happens immediately with this. You're just gone.
What's the sound like? What's the sound like, Rick?
Well, it's very quiet. You don't hear a thing. As a matter of fact, I'm sitting there in the parking lot, and I said, "Well, how do I turn it on?" She said, "Well, you just turned it on by touching the brake." And you don't hear it.
You're turning Marjorie around. I'm watching her turn around right here in the studio.
Wait a minute, Rick.
But let me tell you, though, on the acceleration, it really feels like you're on a roller coaster going downhill. It just pushes you right, even if you're just getting on the highway going from 30 to 50. You feel that pushing you back against the seat. It's got a real sort of intuitive feel to it. It's got this deal where I don't understand the physics of it, but when you let off the accelerator, it sort of breaks the car because it's generating power.
Uh-huh.
So you end up you know, you don't really use the brake until you come into a full stop. So it's it becomes sort of like a one-pedal operation, and that's different. And because all the batteries are in the floor, it's got the lowest center of gravity of any car. So you turn corners really fast without tilting at all. It just feels so stable.
Rick, are you
just
contemplating
a different kind of experience?
Are you contemplating opening a dealership in the lobby of the Metro West Daily News? Hey,
well,
Rick,
I think that...
go ahead.
That's probably the only way I'd be able to drive one of these things regularly because I can't afford a $65,000 car. So I'm not comparing it to a Ferrari or a top of the line Mercedes or anything. But it really is a different experience because of the technology involved. It's
Rick
really
Holmes, cool. Metro West Daily News. Thanks so much for the call. That was a great review. I should say that was terrific. How much excitement in his voice?
And everybody is thrilled about this car. And you know, it's really interesting because Massachusetts isn't the only place that Tesla's fighting this fight. They're fighting it everywhere. They've been shut down in Texas last week.
States have laws like this where there's got to be a middleman. Like,
and, you know, one of the things that's really instructive about this case and what I really learned in this is how complex laws can be, like state laws can be. You go to this, you know, the law about this, it's like, you know, it's law 34B, subsection C, section 10, subsection 4, and it seems clear. And you start to read this and you're like, how much law has been written around this? It's insane.
But suppose they end up having to do the dealership like everybody else.
Yeah.
And we'll still be able to buy the cars. I mean, what's the
– You will. Well, their thing is that they say that they can't do it right now. The problem that they say is basically they're a niche car dealer.
Because there are not enough of them, right?
There's not enough of them. And so what the dealer model – that they said if they're selling enough cars eventually, they would look at that. But right now they say they can't do that because that's the way that people make money in dealerships is by pushing the metal, as they say. And that's the model of economics. That's how everybody makes money. Ford makes money and the dealer makes money when they – push the metal. The problem is Tesla's only sold 300 of them.
What is push the metal? Sell a lot of cars?
Yeah, sell a lot of cars. Okay. It's all about volume of cars being sold.
It seems, you know, this sounds to me like as much money as maybe behind the Tesla. I don't know enough to make predictions, but I will anyway. When you have one company that's manufacturing a limited number of cars versus the auto the dealer's infrastructure, which obviously has wild power, it would seem to me that Tesla may come up short here. But James, you're in Cape Cod. You can finish it off. Hey, James.
Hey, thanks, man. Hey, it's always a pleasure to speak to you guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling, James.
Excellent. Hey, you know, you guys are kind of stealing my idea. I always thought a standardized battery that would simply be removed from a car like you do from a cordless drill and replaced in a car is the key to success in electric vehicles. I mean, you pull into a station, they pop your battery out, put a new one in, they throw the other one on the charging rack, and they just go, you know, from car to car to car. It doesn't matter. You know, if you standardize that energy supply, like we've standardized so much in our society,
we got
that
it.
Would be a great thing.
That is a great thing.
Right. And the other thing,
wait,
Jim,
don't
you know,
go. I'm not going to hang up on you. What was that?
There's like these demos where they show Tesla switching the battery one battery for another. You know, I'm not exactly sure how the charging stations work. You know, but that's I think that's one of the options that you have on the Tesla is to switch out. Certainly, one of them that they're looking at as they try to build this infrastructure.
James, what's your other point?
My other point is, Jim, didn't you ever see the Blues Brothers movie?
Yeah.
And they drove through the mall, and they said, hey, look, the new Oldsmobile. Come on, brother, you know?
James, that was pretty great.
Thank you very much
for the call.
Before we go, since I do have a radio show here, I just want to point out that the little tiny cup holder, you know, that little like about a quarter of an inch of plastic that holds your little cups, I broke that.
Yeah.
You know how much it cost it?
I don't care that much, Margaret, to be fair.
$150.
Okay, fine.
I mean, come on.
Nothing like having an open mind, Marjorie, on the issue. Hey, that was great, Edgar, as always.
Thank you
so much.
When
are you buying one, by the way?
In about 35 years.
Okay.
Buy the tires, too, by the way.
Edgar B. Hurwitz III runs the Curiosity Desk here at WGBH. To learn more about it, go to WGBH.org. Whoops. WGBHnews.org. Excuse me. When we come back, we're going to hear a new twist on the phrase, all politics is local. That's actually next. When we come back, we're going to hear from Brian McGrory, who's the editor of the Boston Globe. That's next on 89.7. I'm so upset about my cup holder, I can't talk. Boston Public Radio.
Higher education. Can we afford it? Can we afford not to? I've been watching the price increase as I go, but I've been trying to obviously not let it deter me from wanting to continue and finish.
Voices of students and administrators, faculty and staff from WGBH's Higher Ed Desk on campus on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Natural Resources Defense Council, inviting you to watch Robert Redford's powerful new video about tar sands oil at demandcleanpower.org. That's demandcleanpower.org. And Bill Haney's North Shore Music Theater, presenting the modern family musical La Cage aux Folles, starring the Nanny's Charles Shaughnessy. North Shore Music Theater in Beverly, September 24th through October 6th. NSMT.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Margaret Egan. We're joined every Wednesday at about this time by the editor of the Boston Globe. He didn't disappoint today. Hello, Brian McGorry.
Hello, Jim Browdy. How are you?
Good.
Hey, Brian.
Hello, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm great. Good to talk to you. You know what I was wondering? This is, of course, the mayoral primary race is going to be on Tuesday. We're only a few days away. You guys endorsed John Conley and John Barrows a couple of days ago. But I think a lot of people wonder about this. How does this happen at the Boston Globe, Brian? Is there a board of people that votes on these guys and the other people that you mentioned? Or is there – who votes? And how does it happen? What are the mechanics?
And it's a good question, and I could actually be asking the same question because I'm not a part of it, as you well know.
Right.
So we have an editorial board here. Editorial board is the editorial page editor, Peter Canellos, the publisher, Chris Mayer, the deputy editorial page editor, Dante Ramos, and several editorial writers and columnists who gather and chat about the various candidates before they've ever gotten together. Virtually all the candidates have come in. All have been invited to meet with the editorial board. They sit in a conference room for, you know, hour and a half, whatever it takes, and have a pretty elaborate discussion about their vision for the city and specific campaign proposals and the like. And then when that series of meetings, which has taken place over the last month or so, ends, all the members of the ed board get together. I don't know if it's like a jury, whether it's an actual vote or whether they just have a pretty in-depth discussion and come to it by consensus. I will tell you, and Marjorie, feel free to differ here. I thought this endorsement editorial was a pretty impressive piece of work. I had never seen one that was quite as elaborate as this. It was a full page in length. It gave a nod to virtually every candidate in the race, and I thought it was pretty well argued why they were endorsing the two they did, John Barrows and John Conley, and then giving another nod to kind of the runner-ups in their derby, Walczak and
Michael Ross.
Which I thought... I thought that was pretty impressive all around.
I thought it was very impressive. I thought it was particularly impressive when you gave a shout out to David James Wyatt or whatever his name is, the guy that sat there kind of Buddha-like with his hands folded across his belly and said virtually nothing this entire race.
Well, they said he provided a Republican option, which he did. He's the only Republican.
I don't know if you needed to include him, but except for that, it was
great. Well, I got to tell you, we did, as you probably saw, we did these candidate kind of campaign profiles two weeks running, and you know there are 12 people in the race, and we got to that one. What's his name again?
David James Wyatt.
Yeah, and he wouldn't return. He wouldn't return our calls. He wouldn't. He wouldn't engage us in any way, and we couldn't do a profile of him because he just wouldn't talk to us. And any profile probably wouldn't have been particularly flattering. And we were trying to make these upbeat assessments, not.
Well, you did write about him, though, and you did say whoever wrote the piece, I can't remember, said the reason this is not on, maybe it was an editor's note, the reason this is not on the front page of the paper like the other profiles is because the guy wouldn't talk to us.
Well,
we did. That was Jen Peter, our Metro editor, very smartly wanted to do a quick profile anyways just to make sure we had that ground covered. And I thought that was a really the right thing to do and a smart thing to do.
Well, his stance is kind of in the debates, you know, when someone actually asks him a question, he looks stunned and shocked that somebody would even ask him a question, begging asking the question, what are you doing there?
Brian, just staying on the process for a second, because every election cycle we get calls, emails, that sort of stuff. When you and I and Marjorie were children, very young, in the 1980s, do you remember when, did you work for the Globe? I'm serious, you weren't at the Globe in the 80s. When did you start at the Globe?
I got to the Globe in 1989.
Okay, well, there was a famous incident where the Globe endorsed Joe Kennedy for Congress to succeed Tip O'Neill. I don't know if you remember this. And subsequently, a piece came out, I think in the Globe itself, I don't know if it was the ombudsperson or whatever it was, saying that the editorial board actually voted 9-3 for George Bachrach, who wasn't endorsed and was overruled by either the editorial page editor or the publisher or that. Do you remember that or you don't?
I don't remember that, but I remember another one, Jim. Do you have a point to make here? Or?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I was asking if you think that process, I actually did have a point. Is that process, does the publisher of the paper, he has the final word on these things, right?
He does, and so I was going to say there was another one that might have been a little
less obscure.
More famous.
Yeah,
1990. When did Bill Weld run against John Silver?
1990. Yeah.
So my understanding then, and I'm probably going to completely screw this up. My understanding then is the editorial page editor Marty Nolan was hell bent on endorsing John Silver, and the publisher overruled
really?
Him. And we endorsed, if I have this right.
You did endorse Weld.
Yes.
We endorsed Bill Weld.
Yeah.
And caused a lot of friction over in that part of the building for a little while and was pretty controversial.
One last editorial thing, and I may have a point here. I'm not sure. I'll see when I'm done talking. Is in the Senate race, let me step back. The question is, what do you think the power of the newspaper editorial in an election, even a close election like this, is? Because I was thinking back to something more recent. In the Democratic Senate primary race that ultimately ended up being Coakley versus Brown, do you remember the Globe endorsed a very accomplished person, Alan Casey.
Yeah.
Founder and former head of City Year. I think even Alan would admit under sodium pentothal, he didn't have one chance in a million of winning that primary. But the sense I got was it was a principled statement. We know he's not going to win, so we're going to endorse the person who less to have an impact and more to make a statement. Do you think that was a fair description of what that was?
I think that was a very fair description of what that was. Same here. Look at John Barros is not polling at the upper echelons of this race by any stretch, and there is another intriguing candidate from the minority community, Golar Richie, who is. And if the Globe wanted to, look like they were going with what in the polls now shows as a stronger candidate, they could have endorsed her. But this was a pretty principled stand that the Ed Board believed that Barros came in. He had a vision for the city that knocked their socks off. We've been hearing all over town that he is a really eloquent, well-prepared candidate on the stump who really looks like he knows where he wants to bring the city. So they went with him. To your question, and it's an excellent question.
Thank you.
There are always excellent questions.
How influential these endorsements are, I have no idea. Mm. I mean, I think back in the day, I'm guessing they were probably more influential.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Back before we had news bombarding us from, every possible angle. And yet, in a close race like this, where voters are struggling to kind of understand the difference between these candidates in a crowded field, who's accomplished, who's not, who stands for what, who doesn't. I have a feeling that a Globe editorial might actually matter in something like this.
Well, I think when you're looking, and everybody said there's so many candidates in this field, and everybody's busy, and who has time? If you can pick up the Globe, you can pick up the Herald, you can look at people who pay attention and get their opinion, knowing the political bent of the messenger. I think people still look at them. I mean, you can look at them online now. You can look at them right before you go in to vote next Tuesday. You can call up online, the editorials. I hope they matter.
I happen to agree with both of you in a close race. Can I ask you another excellent question, Brian?
You only ask, as Marjorie says.
Excellent questions. So. Only.
You know, we discussed this in the wake of the marathon, and obviously this relates to all horror shows where there is chaos. And this is not directed or about the Globe. It's about the news media and people who run institutions like you do. In the immediate aftermath of the shooting at the Naval Yard on Monday, some media outlets had the wrong name for the shooter. Many reported that he had used an AR-15. There were reports that there were multiple shooters, and that changed. Some of it, by the way, attributed to what the authorities were saying, some to erroneous reporting by some outlets. There's this notion that people like you have to balance being first and fast with being accurate. And obviously it matters maybe more on television or radio, but when you tweet, when you have, you know, Boston.com and BostonGlobe.com and all that sort of stuff, it matters. What kind of thought process, what kind of decision making do you go through at moments like that, like you had to do on Monday?
I mean, it's a really good question. The only part I'd modestly disagree with is that it matters more to TV and radio. That's
you're right. That's actually a historical thing. It's not true anymore. You're right. Forget that. You're right.
People for breaking news are as or more reliant.
Yeah, you're totally right. Forget that.
Our website.
Yeah,
so,
you're right.
Look, this was a bit of a mess in Washington in terms of the media coverage right after the shooting for understandable reasons. Authorities were had been getting reports of multiple people involved in terms of shooters. There was a whole lot of confusion. And, you know, we understand that from our marathon coverage. We fully understand that. And it's not inevitable that mistakes are made, but it is understandable. And when you're in the position of, you know, an editor of one of these papers or a broadcast outlet, you have a lot of things going on now. Your stuff is flying at you. Reporters are coming in, excellent reporters are coming in with what they believe is the most up-to-date information. They're relying on sources. They're relying on public statements. They're relying on what they see and hear themselves. And, you know, it can get a little bit crazy what goes out in the ether. And, you know, sometimes mistakes are made.
How much pressure do you feel to be first, Brian?
Less and less.
Really? Why?
Less and less. Here's why. Because, and there's an irony to this, Jim. We all like to be first. We really like to be first. But the mantra here is we'd rather be right than first. And I think that in a media culture where breaking stuff, those news breaks now last for a matter of seconds because everybody is duplicating it virtually immediately. When somebody gets a news break, everybody else has it. They aggregate it, they reproduce it, and it's a momentary, ethereal thing. And what really matters is when you're right, and because that's what people talk about in the end. And look at I am not holier than thou here. We made a mistake or two during the marathon coverage. We did not do it out of a sense of needing to be first. We did it because we thought we had reliable information. And as soon as we knew we were not right, we corrected it. We explained what happened, and we moved on. There are very few news breaks that actually last. And one of them, not to just talk about ourselves, one of them was when our reporter Eric Moskowitz got the hijacking victim during the marathon bombings.
The Asian guy, the Chinese guy who had been driving the car that the Tsarnaevs ended up in.
Yeah. We had that exclusively for a long time because he wouldn't talk to anybody else. So that kind of news break was good. But, you know, look at when you're battling to get information out there, it's not so much being first, it's being right. But you also want to serve the public in the best way you can. And sometimes, you know, you're trying to get information out there that they need. And in this case, you know, some outlets reported that there were as many as three shooters.
Yeah.
And that ended up not being right. But they thought they had it, and they went with it. And, you know, look what happened.
Brian McRoy from the Boston Globe is joining us as he does every Wednesday at this time. Brian, we had a funny front page on the Herald the other day with Marty Walsh, who's running for mayor, standing in front of City Hall saying it should be bulldozed, it's a mess. You guys at the Globe have written a million columns. Alex Beam had a very funny one a few years ago talking about, you know, how City Hall winds up at every architecture lecture in the world getting trashed as one of the world's ugliest buildings. Should we trash City Hall and move it and get something spiffier down there, recreational facilities or like restaurants, apartments, et cetera? What do you think?
I mean, it's a good question. And if it were up to me, not that it ever would be, I don't think I would trash City Hall. I think I would trash City Hall Plaza.
That's a good point. That's ugly, too. Ugly.
I just think it's god-awful. This
awful
sea of bricks in the middle of downtown that is covered in a thin layer of ice in the winter. and is sweltering in the summer. It is the most uninviting place you could. I actually think it might be the single most uninviting place in downtown Boston. And so if you did something with that, you know, throw some trees, throw some sod down, you know, do whatever. I think that City Hall itself would become a whole lot more palatable.
Yeah, I didn't know there was a fountain there for a while that worked for a while, but then it started leaking into the underground garage, and that was the end of that.
So they moved it to the tunnel, I suppose, and let it leak there.
Isn't there some under the plaza? I did stories on this way back when, and aren't there a series of warrens and tunnels and all that kind of stuff under there?
I don't know.
No,
well, the government center T stop is right on the plaza, so I don't know what's under there. Rats is what I assume is under there. Lots of them.
Hey, Brian, we often talk to you in your former life and in your current life about big businesses and equity and all that sort of thing. One of the things that's driving me absolutely off the wall Sunday, as you know, was the fifth anniversary of the bankruptcy filing of Lehman Brothers, which began the near meltdown of the economy in this country. 5 years after, some website, I don't know, Slate, somebody did a profile of the leaders of the five biggest institutions that contributed to this. And the common thread were two things. One, that not one of them was in jail or even charged with any crime. Or two, that all of them were living at the lap of luxury is an understatement, just zillionaires, just living as nothing happened. What's the moral of that story, do you think, 5 years after?
Oh, I mean, look, you know where I am on this, and it drives me crazy. Pay inequity is one of the, if not the single biggest issue this country faces. And along with pay inequity, there is the sense that there's no more economic movement in this country where people don't rise above where they are now. We have the illusion of movement, but the movement itself just isn't there. And it is grotesque when you get people who run huge institutions into the ground but reward themselves and each other, because invariably they all serve on each other's boards of directors and approve each other's multi-million dollar pay packages, reward each other with ridiculous, virtually unimaginable gobs of money. I mean, you know, forget jail time. We don't even need to go that far. Imagine making them earn an honest living rather than, having them get $20 million buyout packages or $30 million bonuses.
Can you imagine?
It's awful.
$20 million buyout packages. I can't even imagine. Hey, you got a great story in the front page of the Globe today by Beth Tytel. I love Beth Tytel. And I know that you're a big dog guy, Brian McGroy, because I read your terrific book, A Buddy, How a Rooster Made Me a Family Man. I just wondered, you know, you are a dog guy, and I'm a dog person. I've been tempted. The service dogs, you know, they have those little jackets they put on, the little outfits,
Marjorie,
which signifies that they are a special working dog. Haven't you ever been tempted? You know, if you're going to a fine dining experience, or maybe you're going to take an airplane or something, you don't want to have to put your dog down there with the baggage and stuff, to kind of slap one of those little uniforms on your dog and take it on, American Airlines, Brian.
Take it away, Brian.
Every person who has ever loved a dog, and that would obviously exclude Jim Browdy, Jim is the type that, he pats a dog, his elbow doesn't bend. You know what I mean?
That's a great line.
He's probably got some made up allergy whenever he gets around an animal, and oh my God, I can't be near it. Every person who has ever loved a dog has imagined being able to put one of these vests around the animal and taking it every single place they go. It really is true. It is absolutely true, Marjorie.
Yeah, I want to develop a chronic illness. You know, it's like people joke about the pot dispensaries. You need a chronic illness to buy your pot legally. I think the same thing is going on with the service dogs. Everybody's plotting their illegal.
I don't think you could put that little vest on your 9-pound dog and convince.
It's a woman on the front page of the paper today. She's a minister. What is her dog? About 11
very small
pounds?
Now, Brian.
A very teeny tiny dog with an adorable little vest.
Bad news for you. I have no more excellent questions. So we're. Yeah, I also want to tell you, by the way, speaking of Peter Kanellis, he is coming on my show tonight, my TV show, to talk about your editorial.
Good.
And that wasn't my point. You said, do I have a point? He is willing to travel. When was the last time you were on my television show, by the way?
I mean, I am. I owe you a huge apology that I am unwilling to neglect my job here at the Globe to drive in rush hour traffic through the city to come out to your godforsaken studio out out on the periphery of the free world.
That's right.
Yes.
During the peak of deadline at this newspaper.
Since you said it so nicely.
I feel awful about that.
Apology accepted. It was that. Brian, it's great to talk to you. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much, Brian McGroy, for being with us again today. Brian McGroy, the editor of the Boston Globe. He is with us every Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, we are joined, as we always are on Thursday, by the great Christopher Lydon. Please tune in for that. And when we come back, we're going to hear a new twist on the phrase, all politics is local. Why mayors should rule the world. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
The moment you walk in the audition room, you see the faces when you have an accent.
This actress from Argentina has a coach to help Americanize her accent because she's tired of being typecast as a maid.
Because you're a Latina, you can't be a successful businesswoman? Oh, come on.
Some actresses are taming their Spanish accents, others cultivating them. That's next time on The World from PRI.
This afternoon at 3 here on WGBH Radio.
We love our contributors. That means you. An Innuendo Natick featuring Hunter Douglas window fashions for controlling light and glare. Innuendo staff can help you select the right Hunter Douglas products and offers full measuring and installation services. Innuendo.com. And Earthflight, a nature special presentation. Take a breathtaking voyage on the wings of the world's birds. This week, explore Europe. Don't miss Earthflight, Wednesday at 8 on WGBH2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. When it comes to ruling the world, the saying all politics is local could take on new meaning. So keep that in mind before you Bostonians decide to sit out next week's runoff election. In his forthcoming book, If Mayors Ruled the World, Benjamin Barber makes the case that a world governed by cities, by city executives, could be the way to go. Typically, mayors exhibit a no-nonsense, bipartisan, pragmatic style of governance that we rarely see coming out of Capitol Hill or state capitals. As famed New York City Mayor LaGuardia put it, there is no Democratic or Republican way of fixing a sewer. Benjamin Barber joins us on the line. He's a senior research scholar at the Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society at City University of New York, and he's the president and founder of the Interdependence Movement. Benjamin Barber, welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Good morning. Pleasure to be with you.
Thank
you. Ours too.
Thank you so much for being here. So a lot of us are disgusted in the United States anyway. We can't get anything done down in Washington, all this partisanship, gridlock, et cetera. Why would the mayors running things be a great thing here and across the world? Why is your thesis going to work?
Well, there are a couple of very strong reasons. And by the way, the most important is that this isn't just a prescriptive case that they should. In many ways, they already are. That is to say, mayors are already engaged in inner city associations and in global associations where they're cooperating together to solve problems or at least address problems of transportation, climate change, and even national security in ways that a lot of Americans aren't aware of. So they're already doing it. But the other reason is, and I think your listeners can really sympathize with this, cities, communities, neighborhoods are where we're born, where we go to school and grow up, where we work, where we pray and play, and eventually where we die. You know, they are the real political communities that touch us. National governments are about taxes, about distant legislation, about presidents and prime ministers we may or may not feel we have a connection with. But the communities that we live in, our towns and cities and neighborhoods, are proximate to us, are really part of us. And that's why, in a sense, mayors don't have a choice. And you quoted LaGuardia in the opening saying, you know, I'll fix your sewers for you. They have to. They have to fix the sewers. They have to make the schools run. They have to deal with immigrants, whether they're illegal or not. They've got to provide jobs. They've got to keep the buses and subways moving. That's where the rubber hits the road, and those are the political communities that absolutely have to work.
Hey, Benjamin Barber, there was a book written a couple of decades ago that was huge in governmental circles, written by a Massachusetts guy, David Osborne, Laboratories of Democracy, saying the states should be them. Now you seem to be saying cities should be laboratories of democracy. Give us a couple examples of what you talked about a minute ago, areas where huge gains have been made either by mayors or a compact of mayors that most of us don't know about.
Well, let me take perhaps the most urgent problem we face in the 21st century, which is climate change. And we know that since the Kyoto Protocol, many years ago. States have been gathering since Copenhagen the last 5 years ago, trying to develop a upgraded Kyoto Protocol that deals with the realities of the 21st century, and they failed to do so. Every year they meet in Durban or Mexico City or back in Copenhagen, and they get together in about 200 nations and say, we can't do it. We're sovereign. We're independent. We can't monitor one another. We're not willing to do it. And they go home. Cities, meanwhile, deal with the reality that 80% of carbon emissions actually come from cities, which means they actually can do something about it, and secondly, that they can do something about it through urban policies. Everything from the new pedestrian zones that are being developed around the world, bike share programs that started in the 60s and 70s in Seattle and Latin America. Now,
which Boston is playing up big time right now in a thing called Hubway, by the way, but go ahead.
Yeah, I know that, and that's great. And also unlikely cities like Chicago and even Los Angeles are using bike sharing. You think bikes in Los Angeles, but the fact is it really does make a difference. But there are bigger things they can do, too. When Mayor Villaraigosa came into his seat in Los Angeles 7 or 8 years ago, he wanted to do something about the heavy carbon emissions in Los Angeles. And like most of us, like me and you probably, he figured it was going to be the freeways that were in cars that were the primary problem. But it turned out that Los Angeles, as the largest port in the United States, actually had a port facility that was responsible for up to 40% of carbon emissions. So what he did, through private-public partnerships and working with the ship lines and the trucking lines, he got the diesel freighters and container ships and oil ships that come into the port and sit at anchor for 3 or 4 days with their diesels idling and polluting. He got them to convert so that they could hook up to electric sockets on the shore, very much the way pleasure yachts do in Boston and New York. And instead of idling on diesel, they use electricity. That had a tremendous impact. He also got the 12,000 trucks a day that come in and out of the port loading and unloading cargoes and he did this with a private-public partnership, to upgrade their engines to hybrid engines and save an extraordinary amount of carbon that way. In the end, over 4 or 5 years, and without U.S. support, because he asked Obama for help in the beginning, and Obama said, look, I can't get anything done in Washington. I certainly can't help you on this. He managed to cut about one half of the port carbon emissions. Now, if you figure that's 40% of L.A.'s carbon, cutting half of that is, 16-20% of carbon there. In New York, which is a different kind of town, we have a big port, but that's not the issue. In New York, it's an old housing stock and an old building stock, and a lot of our energy here leaks away, whether it's heating in the winter or air conditioning in the summer. So with the so-called LEED program, Mayor Bloomberg was able to impose new restrictions on insulation for old buildings, which had to be rehabbed and converted, and new buildings, higher standards, such that, again, in New York, he had a profound effect on carbon emissions merely by imposing insulation standards on old and new housing. So mayors have found they can do that one by one. There are also a number of important global associations.
Before you get to the global association, can I stay local?
It's
fine.
Interrupt me.
That's fine. No. I'm loving this.
Jim loves to interrupt.
No, especially, Benjamin, as you know, we're 6 days away from a mayoral runoff, so the relevance is huge. Benjamin Barber has written this book. It's coming out in a couple of months, of Mayors Ruled the World. I want to ask you about two in particular, specifically because you mentioned climate change. This morning, we were told that of 34 American cities, Boston was voted the most energy efficient. So I'm curious to know, how is Menino practicing what you're preaching? And a second guy in the same breath, Rahm Emanuel, who has gone from obviously being a member of Congress, being the chief of staff to the president, and all of a sudden going from the biggest national, international stage to becoming mayor of Chicago. How are those two guys doing in the Benjamin Barber book?
I mean, they're doing extremely well, and they're doing it. And Rahm Emanuel is a great case because he goes from the Capitol in Washington, where very little happens, to Chicago, where a lot can happen. Menino's been there for a couple of decades and able really to do important work. In fact, the anomaly here, by the way, is Cory Booker, who is leaving Newark, having done a great job there, to become a senator in Washington. And I think he's going the wrong direction. I think he's going from power to powerlessness. But anyway, Menino, Rahm Emanuel, Villaraigosa, while he was there, John Hickenlooper in Denver, you can go on, you know, naming them, Nutter in Philadelphia. These are mayors who have found that not by simply telling people what to do, which Bloomberg did a little too often, but rather by forming public-private partnerships, by working with unions and business, not one or the other, by making friends throughout the city. I think the joke is, and it seems half true, that Menino has met at least half of the population of Boston.
No, it actually is true. Polls show almost 60%.
That's what they say, and that's true. You know, Mayor Koch used to wander around New York saying, you know, how am I doing? I don't think Obama or Putin, for that matter, would want to wander around their streets asking, how am I doing? They wouldn't want to hear the answer. They wouldn't be doing it anyway.
We're talking with Benjamin Barber, whose new book, If Mayors Rule the World, comes out in November. You talk about this parliament of mayors. So what's your vision? What would that mean?
Well, let me say that, the interesting thing is we tend to think, you started saying all politics is local, cities are parochial, they're local, and they are. That's to be sure. It's where we live. It's where we all are. And it seems to be the most local and parochial of political levels. But the reality is cities around the world face the same global challenges, whether it's climate change or whether it's security, and they also share common problems. And increasingly, they have begun to understand that they can share best practices, that they can exchange views, and that they can also do things together that can't be done alone. Los Angeles was working with Shanghai. China wasn't working with the U.S., but Los Angeles worked with Shanghai and other port cities, Rotterdam, to consider the best ways to green up their ports. So cities are beginning to work together, and there are a whole series of city associations. I like to call them the most important political institutions nobody's ever heard of. For example, ICLE, I-C-L-E-I, which is an international environmental organization that has been going for about 25 years, in which cities meet, exchange practices, talk about how they can work together to improve curb the carbon output in their cities. And this is happening in domains like immigration, transportation, education, and even in national security, believe it or not. And cities are finding that they can do things together, city to city, that they can't do when they go through the national capital.
Even though historically mayors compete with other mayors for businesses and things like that, as opposed to working cooperatively. You know, Benjamin Barber, one of the things that I think the thesis and the reason I think people will connect to this is what Marjorie said to you at the beginning, gridlock in Washington, gridlock in many state capitals, because there's that constant tension between legislative bodies and obviously chief executives. It seems to me one of the reasons why mayors have the potential or exercise the potential you talk about is because for the most part, with some exceptions, strong mayors like Tom Menino, for example, in Boston, have completely powerless, almost ceremonial city councils. They won't like to hear it because half the city council is running for mayor. But isn't that part of the thing, too? They have much more autonomy than a governor or a president has on most legislative things, no?
Well, yes and no. Let me say, yes, it's certainly true that the mayor is not just a figurehead, but exercises real power. We have to know, to be fair, the reality is that there's a great deal of variety from city to city in the United States and from cities throughout the world. We know that in the 1920s and 30s, in the progressive era, when there's a lot of corruption among mayors, a lot of towns put city managers in place. And some of those towns are still around today.
I live in one. By the way, Cambridge has a weak mayor. I was a city councilor in Cambridge. Okay. We won't talk about that. And the city manager, who virtually nobody knows, totally runs the city.
Well, exactly. So we, you know, realistically, as sort of social scientists and sharp observers, we'd have to say there's a lot of variety. But the fact is, cities, however they're represented by strong or weak city councils, by strong mayors, by city managers, are in a position to deal with issues that I think a lot of average citizens don't realize. Let me give you the example of national security, because a lot of people say, well, carbon emissions, okay, I can see that. But how can cities respond to national security issues? And this is something that affects Boston directly, because after 9/11, Ray Kelly made the decision, after having had his intel squad, the New York
Police Commissioner in New York City, for those who don't know.
For the intel, they were sending all their guys, 9 or 10 detectives, to Washington, to the new Homeland Security Department. After a couple of years, by 2003, they came back and said, you know, this is pointless. Nobody's talking to each other. There's no intel about foreign terrorism in Washington. We're getting nothing. And Kelly and Bloomberg made the brilliant decision to redeploy the New York intel squad to other cities, not to Washington, but to other cities. So they sent somebody to Frankfurt, somebody to Sao Paulo, somebody to Jakarta, somebody to Singapore, somebody to London, someone to Frankfurt, and they began dealing one police department to another police department in the urban areas where intel information on terrorists was really important. And one of the reasons, by no means the only one, but one of the reasons New York has stayed so safe in the years after 9/11 has been because they probably have the best foreign intel operation in the world. Now, this affects Boston in the following way. We know now, we all found out, that Putin and Russian intelligence and Moscow intelligence had informed the FBI that the two young men who were responsible for the Boston bombing actually had records which were suspicious, and the FBI was told, keep an eye on them. The FBI not only didn't do that, they did not tell the Boston police. And when the Boston police later found out that, in fact, there had been warnings about these guys, they were rightly furious, because had Boston had a detective in Moscow, they may well have gotten onto that intel and been in a position to preempt the marathon bombings. But because they were relying on Washington and the gridlock of Washington, it turns out they didn't get absolutely vital intel information that was actually out there and available. I mean, that's an example of how even in the national security field, when cities work with other cities, when police departments work with other urban police departments around the world, they can begin to work mutually to protect their citizens from one, the bad guys, from the terrorists, because they have a common interest.
You know, you should just know on that one issue, just for the moment, that when Ed Davis, our police commissioner, testified in front of Congress and said they hadn't heard that information from the so-called Joint Terrorism Task Force, there was actually, just for the record, some backpedaling on that later as to what they knew and didn't know, but the essence of what you're saying, I think we both agree with big time.
Well, no, that's right. And I think you're right. I mean, we don't know exactly how that info got through and went down. But had Boston had the same kind of city-to-city network that New York has, it certainly would have improved their posture.
Absolutely.
Benjamin, one last question for me. You do mention, though, that if cities try to do some things that are kind of out of the box, like pass their own gun laws like D.C. did, or an example you gave of city boycotting goods created by child labor, that they could be held in violation of the World Trade Organization's fair trade rules, or in the case of the D.C. gun laws, struck down, you know, by the Supreme Court. So if cities want to do those things, they risk getting overruled by the feds, right?
They do. That's a powerful point and a powerful reality. Federalism is not necessarily the city's friend as they try to act more autonomously and more globally to deal with problems. And it's irony that in the 19th and 20th century, it was often the feds who were progressive and cities that were recalcitrant and, you know, obstructing civil rights and so on, whereas we've seen more recently that cities are often progressive and the state and federal levels are more recalcitrant in stopping them. But there are two remedies for that. One is 78% of Americans live in cities. Our political system doesn't reflect that. The Senate has a rural bias, a small population state bias, and gridlock in Washington means that cities often get screwed. But the fact is, the majority of Americans live in cities, so they are in a position to push hard to do this. Secondly, one of the other problems is that cities in America are defined 19th century style by territory back then, not by the reality of the metropolitan regions today. And a great example of that is Detroit. Detroit is bankrupt because within the old city limits of Detroit, very little of the economic power of Michigan is arrayed. But in the 10 counties around Detroit, which make up the greater Detroit metropolitan region, those are doing extremely well. The city of Detroit's bankrupt. It's gone down. It's less than half of its former population. But the population of those 10 counties has doubled. It's the number 4 new economy region in America. It's doing extremely well. If Detroit were defined legally and economically by the region, it actually helps to govern and inspires and draws jobs for and so forth, it would be doing just fine. So another thing we have to think about under federalism is how to make sure that cities aren't defined narrowly in 19th century terms, but defined in terms of the populations that they serve, that they draw their resources from.
Well, also, I mean, regionalization would save money when there are cities and towns are in huge financial trouble. One last question for me, Benjamin Barber, we only have a minute left, is, you know, the 12 people running for mayor, most of them are pretty seriously competent people. They know how to fix a pothole. They know how to make trains run on time. But I read in one of the pieces we were quoted, they need to be, quote, good inner city cooperators. Does the average mayoral candidate or relatively new mayor have any of those skills? They've never had to use them before.
Well, not necessarily. And that's why I think the citizens of Boston and in every city where there's a mayoral election ought to be putting to their mayoral candidates the question, we know what you're going to do here. What are you going to do to help Boston play a role in an interdependent world where the challenges are global? Are you going to be able to play a global role? That's part of your new portfolio. Not in the old days, but now it is. And those questions have to be put just along with the questions, what are you going to do on school reform? What are you doing on transportation and so on?
Benjamin Barber, that was great. We can't wait for your book.
Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us. We much appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
Benjamin Barber is a senior research scholar at the Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society at the City University of New York and the president and founder of the Interdependence Movement. His book, If Mayors Rule the World, comes out in November. And when we come back, food writer Corby Comer joins us to tell us how when you go out to dinner now, the chef, not you, the diner, could decide what you're going to have to eat. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
We, 20 years ago, had a horrendous problem with gun violence. Today, it's much less, but still remains a problem.
WGBH News political analyst David Bernstein.
And there's a sense that Tom Menino has brought the city a certain distance, but now someone with new ideas has to step in and bring it to the next level.
Get to know all the Boston mayoral candidates online at WGBHnews.org.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Grogan & Company, fine art auctioneers and appraisers, supporting American Public Media's business and economic news show, Marketplace, weekdays from 6 to 6:30 p.m. on 89.7 WGBH. And New England Audi dealers with 5 new Audi TDI clean diesel models, proud sponsors of the Taste of WGBH Food and Wine Festival 2013. You can see the new Audi A8 TDI clean diesel at newenglandaudidealers.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Food writer Corby Comer in Studio 3 with us answers a question he himself posed in a piece he wrote for Vanity Fair. The title of the piece is Tyranny, It's What's for Dinner. And here's the question he asks. How did the diner get demoted from honored guest, whose wish was the waiter's command, to quivering hostage and thrall to the chef's iron whim? As I said, here to answer his own question is Corby Comer. Corby, it's great
Hi,
to see
Corby.
You.
Hi, Corby.
Great to be here.
Thanks for coming back in. So what is the answer to Jim's question?
Well, we decided that we love chefs as entertainment, and we love going out to dinner and watching people. And that sort of goes with buying into the whole celebrity culture. If they're celebs, they must know what's right. They must know what you want to eat.
So is that – and the tasting menu, I assume, is the manifestation of this notion. Sit down. What do you say in your piece? Strapped into your chair. And then essentially they'll serve you what they think you should want to eat, correct?
Yeah, sit down and shut up, enjoy it, and pay through the nose. So that's kind of the underlying philosophy. That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is I am an artist. I am a chef. I want to show you what I can do, and I want you to appreciate my artistry, and I will use – the best ingredients available at the market from my purveyors, from my fishermen, from my farmers. I'm going to bring you the best of what there is in a way that is surprising and delightful and enthralling and you will never forget.
Why do we take this? I mean, not only – you know, when I say why do we take it, you wrote brilliantly about this place in Chicago where people wait months to get in and then they fly out there just to have dinner at the inconvenient hour that they allowed them to come in. Why do we allow ourselves to be submit to this?
I think one of the reasons is that restaurants have become our form of entertainment. It's what we're willing to pay for. Now that you can see a movie, you can listen to whatever record you want to do, online in the comfort of your and laziness of your own home while you're multitasking, of course. One of the few entertainment options we're willing to pay for is a night out at a restaurant where we actually aren't necessarily glued to the screen, although it's so surprising how many people are when you go out to eat.
It is. But this is a whole trend, a pernicious trend in most instances, you call it. This tasting menu thing, which I, being out of it as I am, didn't even know was a big trend. So explain to people what the tasting menu is.
So first I'll explain it, and then I'm going to go right up against myself because we writers tend to do that. So what it is you eat anywhere from 4 to 5 courses, which used to be the hallowed French way of doing it because it was very economical. You saved money. It was a good deal. You got what was best at the market at cheap rates. But it morphed into 12, 15, 18, 42 courses. As part of a spectacular one night in your life you will never forget special occasion dinner. There aren't that many restaurants in Boston that do it. One which will remain unnamed and is not in Boston proper, it's somewhere outside of Boston, has that kind of 12 to 18 grim, mouth set in a straight, unsmiling line. You don't ask for a substitution. We'll ask you if you're allergic to anything, and then we really don't want to hear from you except nice things. That's one option. Then, and they take themselves so seriously. It's, you know, very dogmatic.
But you just wrote this piece in Boston Magazine praising what you damn in Vanity Fair. This place, Asta, what had opened earlier this year, a tasting menu joint, and you're raving about it.
I know. I never expected to. Well, for one thing, it gives you a 3-course option, which none of these tasting menu places do.
There are many more.
Just three. There's a 3, a 5, and an 8. An 8 as far as it goes. So 8 sounds staggeringly high to most listeners. It's really restrained for most tasting menu places. My God, I can get out of there with only 8 courses. I had the 8 courses once. The places that are really smart and do this actually weigh the amount of food you will have by the end of the evening, and they will calibrate courses by whether it's 3 courses, 5, or 8. And I think that Alex Crabb, the owner and chef of Asta, which I really like. It's pasta without the P at the top of Back Bay. I think he does that. You don't feel overfull, and it also moves at quite a clip, so you don't feel like it's
And you don't feel
agonizing.
Like a hostage either, like you wrote about in
no,
this other setting.
They're really happy to see you there.
But I must ask you, right in the lead of your story in Boston Magazine is a description of one of the signature dishes, weeds and live ants.
Oh, wait a minute. I didn't have live ants there. That is at Noma, the famous restaurant in Copenhagen.
Oh, that you were comparing.
Oh, okay.
Which I admit I love.
Okay, live ants. So, I mean, do you chase them around the dish with your fork and try to stab them as they're running? I mean, what do you do?
You do. It's part of the adventure of going out these days. There's one restaurant, not in downtown Boston, that was serving, I can't remember, I think it's crickets. And they hadn't told the diners because they thought they might be a little freaked out if they knew what was coming. So these insects arrived on your plate. It's disconcerting.
Alive?
Yeah.
Ah!
Alive.
God.
Alive. Alive.
Can I
alive.
Get back to the changing balance
wait
that exists
minute,
in some of these?
I just want to ask you before you move. With the ants, what do people do? How do they get them in their mouth if
okay,
they want
you
them?
Know, they are actually, they get trapped in a cream sauce and you get them in
Slows
a spoon.
Them down.
Oh, that's disgusting.
Okay, let's get back to this change in balance. The theory that I grew up in when I was ever able to afford to go to a really nice restaurant once a month, once every 2 months, one of these kinds of places, was they'd really treat you like a king or a queen if you went. You were the reason the customer is always right, that kind of thing. Then all of a sudden, and you write about the celebrity chef and his or her iron whim. It's not just them. Marjorie and I and Emily and whatever went out last night to dinner to a relatively fine restaurant. We're not going to mention it. The waiter treated us like we were essentially interfering in his night's activities. And it was a condescension kind of thing that I found so off-putting. That's part of the same shtick, is it not? You're lucky to be allowed into a place that is so fine, whereas you say artists are at work in every place. When did that change? When did that happen?
I think there's always been haughtiness and snottiness, starting with Le Pavillon, which was the restaurant that Jack and Jackie Kennedy right. went to that came out of the World's Fair in New York. So there's always been this hauteur and snobbiness, and you really have to belong to get in. That's supposed to go the way of, you know, snail mail. We're not supposed to be doing that anymore. And people like Garrett Harker at Eastern Standard are, setting a new standard for service in Boston. But, you know, I think it's also part of buying into the celebrity culture. If there's a celebrity there, maybe you really don't deserve to be there. And, you know, the really top chefs like Tom Colicchio or Mario Batali, who have very cannily used TV celebrity to make money, they make sure that the service is good at their restaurants. You know, the other people who are careless, it's just kind of ridiculous. But, you know, you're lucky that you didn't have the waiter I had at a place I recently reviewed in Boston Magazine, where we were speculating as to why Tina Fey had ended 30 Rock. This waiter was at his station entering an order. He came over with a sponge and pretended to wipe our table for 3 minutes while he told us the ins and outs of her contract, exactly how much money she would make on per movie as opposed to what she was making on 30 Rock, depending on whether it went into syndication. It went on and on. We were just astounded. You know, he joined the conversation. So there's several approaches to service. I take friendliness anytime. I've just been at some of the Barbara Lynch Empire. They care about service. You know, most of the good places in
Boston
do. But
is it a conscious – is there a – I mean, obviously these people want to make money, and most of them are very good business people. Is there this notion that maybe there's either a masochistic streak in the diner, or maybe they do want to be abused a little bit because that shows how – top of the line we are and how – I mean, it's got to be conscious. It isn't.
Lest we forget, Boston is the home of Durgan Park. What was Durgan Park famous for? You know, Indian
nasty.
Pudding and mean waitresses.
Yeah. Abuse,
nasty
yeah.
waitress.
And abuse.
Yeah, that's right. They would chase you down and throw the pennies at you if you didn't give them a good tip. And they were battle axes, too, these tough-looking women, right? It was
right.
great.
Exactly.
How great does it feel when
kind
you
of like Brookline Meter Maids, not to name names.
There's yeah. a different name for them these days. What are they called, Meter Maids?
Traffic
enforcement,
traffic
whatever.
Traffic assistance or something. I don't know. So is it so the tasting menu generally is something we should avoid or – generally because
I don't believe in it because of the inflexibility, because when you go in, yes, the chef might be an artist, but let me decide which paintings I want to see,
yeah.
which art I want to experience, because, you know, you can take it at your own pace. It's very hard to be kind of assaulted by an avalanche of new foods and new dishes. I completely believe in trying new things and think everybody should be open to it. But maybe not all at once. People experience art, if we're going to call it art, at their own pace.
Isn't right. there what tapas is? I mean, tapas is sort of like a tasting menu that you create yourself as you go, isn't that?
Right. It can be. The thing about most tapas is it's in a very classic, set, time-hallowed way. So once you know the repertoire, you kind of have done it.
Yeah.
And most of these other chefs who are trying to experiment, they're constantly changing up their menus.
The front page of the Globe the other day had the picture of this gorgeous woman that just won Top Chef, and now she had been a model, and now she's back in Boston opening a restaurant. And I was surprised to see that on the front page of the Globe, but she's become a big celebrity when she was on this TV show.
You're not seeing me roll my eyes inwardly, but the two things, beauty, Top Chef, celebrity, front page photo, you know, that's what's wrong with food today, or it's part of what's wrong with food today. We should be looking at the inner beauty of the
okay,
chef.
Okay, in 45 seconds, Corby, tell us the best meal you've had at a place that got it exactly right in the last 6 to 12 months.
Thanks for asking. The two are Asta, the three-course tasting menu with some substitutions from the five-course. I really like Alex Crabb and his food. Mm-hmm. And Giulia, spelled G-I-U-L-I-A, between Porter Square and Harvard Square in Cambridge, where there's kind of right on classic Italian food using local ingredients in a
Ooh.
Very homey, heartfelt, expert way.
And in 15 seconds, on days when I feel like I want to be abused, where
it's
should
tough.
I go?
Oh, gosh, if you want to be
I really
abused,
want to be treated really badly for one particular and charge more than I should be.
Go to Durgan Park. If only the old Ritz, now the Taj, where they were so clueless on top of it.
They were? I remember going to the Ritz-Carlton like 30 years ago. I was so excited. They had those little ice sculptures they'd come out with. It was very, the food was terrible. But
yeah, it had nothing to do with food. Everything to do with attitude.
Corby, it's great to see you. We love your attitude. Talk to you soon, Corby Comer.
And you.
Okay, and
here.
They're both great pieces. One in Vanity Fair and one in Boston Magazine by Corby Comer, K-U-M-M-E-R, senior editor at The Atlantic and an award-winning food writer. Thanks, you guys, for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Christopher Lydon and his take on the play All the Way, now on stage at the Art. It's starring the star of Breaking Bad. What's his name, Jim?
Bryan Cranston. I saw it over the weekend.
Did you see it?
It is spectacular.
Our show is a production of WGBH. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
Thanks for tuning in.